Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of August 21st, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
As a matter of fact, we are the only true and living Mormon News Report show on the face of the earth with whom the internet is well pleased. Brian, I believe that is scripture. If it's not, you can go ahead and mark it because we're going to make it so.
I think it might be scripture, Brand. I'm not sure. But listen, we have a fun show lined up today. Dr. Elizabeth Fenton from the University of Vermont is going to join us to talk about a Book of Mormon class that she's been teaching to, well, mostly non-Mormon students. And we've got a lot of news to discuss from this week.
But before we begin, just a quick reminder, like we do every week, about our extended sessions that are available to the Patreon.com subscribers to the Mormon News Report. For just $1 per month, you will receive access to the longer interviews that we've been doing with many of our guests, where we roll up our sleeves, crack open a cold one of whatever beverage of choice that you want, and just chit-chat with them.
You know, we get into some exclusive stuff that you just won't hear anywhere else.
Think of it kind of like the director's cut of the Mormon News Report, if you will. Plus, your $1 a month will help support our efforts to provide you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news. A big shout out this week to Michael Austin, who recently pledged $10 per month. Wow. A huge, huge thank you, Michael. We really appreciate it. For the rest of our listeners, just head over to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a Patreon subscriber today.
So I don't know if you heard the news, Brant, but today is President Thomas S. Monson's 90th birthday. Can you imagine being born 90 years ago and how much the world has changed since then?
Oh, man. You know, I was born 33 years ago and the world's changed a ton. Okay, let me do some quick math in my head. If my math's correct, that is, what, 1927-ish, I think, when he was born? And again, let me just do some quick digging into my head for random obscure pieces of knowledge. If I remember correctly, that's the same year that Charles Lindbergh flew the Spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic.
I think you're the only person who would know that. But it was also the same year that work began on Mount Rushmore and the first transatlantic telephone call was made from New York City to London.
How about this one? The Jazz Singer also opened in 1927. That was the first feature-length motion picture with music and speech.
Yeah, a lot has changed since then. Well, President Monson, on behalf of the Mormon News Report, we wish you a happy 90th.
You know what? If I could compliment you, President Monson, you really don't look a day over 89. Ba-dum-ts. But seriously, y'all, we wish him very, very well. Brian, we have a ton of news to get into from the week, so let's get started in India, where Elder D. Todd Christofferson recently accepted a humanitarian award that, I can't really pronounce it.
Well, let me give it a shot. The Philosopher Saint Sri Dhaneshwar World Peace Prize. Did I nail it?
You know what? Let's go ahead and go with that. This award, the thing that Brian said, was given in honor of the LDS Church's global charitable and humanitarian programs, which since 1985 have provided nearly $2 billion in aid in 189 countries.
So Vishwanath D. Karad, founder and president of MIT World Peace University, noted in his speech at this ceremony a recent visit that he made to Utah and his impression that the Mormons had, quote, much in common with Indian culture.
For example, the biggest holy festival, or the Krishna Festival of Colors outside of India, takes place in Spanish Fork, Utah at the Sri Krishna Temple.
It's true. The festival has become an annual pilgrimage for more than 70,000 Utahns and one actual Hindu who, quite frankly, is getting a little annoyed that he can't find parking.
Oh, Brian, let's also not forget the hordes and hordes of BYU students who flock to the Sri Krishna Temple in Spanish Fork because, quote, and I've heard this before, this will totes look amazing on Insta.
Kids these days. Well, speaking of large gatherings of Mormons and Mormon kids, our next topic is about a music festival that's aimed at supporting LGBTQ youth charities that's going to be held in Orem, Utah this coming weekend.
So this event, which is called the Love Loud Festival, is being held at Utah Valley University's Brent Brown Ballpark. Say that one three times fast. And will feature two internationally acclaimed bands, Imagine Dragons and Neon Trees, both of whom trace their roots to Utah and both of whom have some Mormon connections.
Yeah. So the event was organized by Dan Reynolds of the Grammy Award winning band Imagine Dragons. And incidentally, Reynolds is also creating a film that will be aimed at the LDS Church and LGBTQ youth.
But perhaps the biggest surprise to this story was a statement of support for the Love Loud Festival issued by none other than, wait for it, the LDS Church.
What?
Brian, it's true.
As a matter of fact, the statement released by Church PR Department read in part, "We applaud the Love Loud Festival for LGBTQ youth's aim to bring together people to address teen safety and to express respect and love for all of God's children. We join our voice with all who come together to foster a community of inclusion in which no one is mistreated because of who they are or what they believe.
It continued, we share common beliefs, among them the pricelessness of our youth and the value of families. We earnestly hope this festival and other related efforts can build respectful communication, better understanding, and civility as we all learn from each other, which I think one could say that's a small victory, right?
Yeah, and it doesn't stop there. The church-owned Deseret News even published a Q&A with Dan Reynolds about the Love Loud Festival, and he was pretty candid about the higher rates of suicide among LGBTQ youth, his own coping with having lost a few friends to suicide, as well as the tensions between his Mormon identity and his views on homosexuality.
So, look, I know that we try to be silly on this show, but when we're talking about a serious issue such as LGBTQ youth and suicide, it's time to put funny guy Brant aside and give this the gravity it deserves. I'm talking like shirt and tie business Brant. So first, let me make clear that I really do applaud Dan Reynolds for his efforts in organizing this event. This is a great thing that he's doing. Having celebrity status means that he can get the attention of the media, which is where the conversation just begins to start. Similarly, I'm also proud of the LDS Church and the Deseret News for publicly stating their support. I think this is a great opportunity for the church to show that it isn't as bigoted as perhaps many feel, and they didn't let that opportunity pass by. However, I also see the other side of the fence, where many who have either lost their LGBTQ friends or family to suicide, or those who feel shunned by either the church or their families because they are gay, may have some mixed feelings over the church's public support for this.
So, for example, singer of Neon Trees, Tyler Glenn, himself a gay former Mormon, called the church's public support a, quote, PR move and said, is it enough? No. Is it a step? Absolutely. Is it confusing? Absolutely.
And he's not wrong there. So on the one hand, it's thank you for supporting this, which is very legitimate. But on the other hand, Mormon culture and the church's policies against same-sex marriage and families have caused a lot of deep pain for many. I think it's important that we acknowledge that and that we get that out there in the open. So I get it. There are deeper issues at the center of this that, for many, are still a fresh wound. And in cases like this where a peace offering is made, it can bring a false sense of hope for eventual change in the church's stance on same-sex marriage. But I think we need to acknowledge that the church likely sees supporting LGBTQ individuals as a separate issue from accepting same-sex relationships, and that is a tension that isn't going to go anywhere anytime soon.
At the same time, any opportunity to bring two sides together in open support and civility is always a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. And it's something that we desperately, desperately need at this time in 2017, where it seems like that is something that is just pulling apart really our entire culture and our entire nation. Okay, so Brian, we got that out of the way. What's next? I hope it's something light. I could go for something a little light today.
Oh, it's light, as in light-skinned. Our top story this week is dealing with the white nationalist protest that took place in Charlottesville.
Oh, yeah. All right. If you've turned on your television or computer at all, you've no doubt seen the throngs of angry, militant, and very white protesters carrying tiki torches in protest of the removal of a few Confederate statues.
But what got me was how average these white nationalists looked. I mean, most of them just look like college frat boys, not the typical image of a Confederate flag-waving Southern pride redneck that you would expect.
Oh, it's true. The photos that I've seen look more like a clip from the movie Revenge of the Nerds, as if the nerds were marching from their frat house to the football field to finally stand up to those mean jocks.
With tiki torches.
Because nothing says white pride like faux Polynesian culture and made-in-China mosquito torches.
And nothing screams insecurity like saying it with fire. You know, I mean, it's like they stopped at Pier 1 Imports on their way into their white nationalist rally. At any rate, the Mormon connection to this story begins with a pretty generic statement that was initially released from the LDS Church.
The statement read, "It is with great sadness and deep concern that we view the violence, conflict, and tragedy of recent days in Charlottesville, Virginia. People of any faith or of no faith at all should be troubled by the increase of intolerance in both words and actions that we see everywhere." It then went on to quote President Gordon B. Hinckley, saying, "No man who makes disparaging remarks concerning those of another race can consider himself a true disciple of Christ, nor can he consider himself to be in harmony with the teachings of the Church of Christ."
So while it's something, it's also your typical paint-by-numbers PR statement. First, you express sadness, then you reinforce the religious freedom narrative, quote a church leader or two, and then offer your thoughts and prayers. I mean, Brant, it's not a bad thing. I'm not trying to harp on it too much. President Hinckley's talk from 2006 regarding racism was a very powerful talk.
Okay, well, I'll harp on it a little bit. It was pretty milquetoast, that statement, and it left many on the internet upset that it didn't go further.
And in a weird twist, there were some on the internet who felt like it sort of validated them.
Ah, yes. Enter Ayla Stewart, also known as Wife with a Purpose on Twitter. And let me just acknowledge the fact that we don't want to give a lot of airtime to someone like this. However, I think it's important, Brian, that we get it out there that this is who she is and this is a big part of the story.
Yeah, as much as we don't want to give her any attention, in this instance, she's sort of at the center of this. So here's what went down. After the church issued their statement, Stewart posted a series of tweets stating that the LDS church teachings are clear. You cannot be anti-white and a follower of Christ. And then she also said, unfortunately, like everything, the social justice warriors will twist this and use it to further alienate and attack white people, history, and culture. And the racism and violence that we have seen from Antifa, leftists, and Black Lives Matter this year must be more specifically addressed by the church.
Oh, Brian, address it. They did.
On Tuesday, Mormon Newsroom issued another statement saying, it has been called to our attention that there are some among the various pro-white and white supremacy communities who assert that the church is neutral toward or in support of their views. Nothing could be further from the truth. In the New Testament, Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The Book of Mormon teaches all are alike unto God. White supremacist attitudes are morally wrong and sinful, and we condemn them. Church members who promote or pursue a, quote, white culture or white supremacy agenda are not in harmony with the teachings of the church.
Ooh, that was good. So translation, you didn't get it before, so we're going to make it absolutely 100% crystal clear. Brian, I can't imagine Stewart like that, did she?
No, not at all. So she retweeted a screenshot of their statement and wrote, my church just declared that I, as a white person, have no culture. She further decried the statement as a PR move, which kind of seems to be our theme this week, and demanded to hear this directly from the First Presidency.
She took that public censure a bit hard. She also wrote, this is a dark day, the day the LDS church turned its back on its white members. And while we could go on and on and on, she also wrote, the church just declared that I have no right to my heritage or culture. I am white. My culture is white culture.
Brant, there are a lot of unhinged people on the internet, but Stewart is a special sort of crazy.
So, Brian, there seems to be some confusion out there among a few people. So let's make a few things clear, shall we?
First, the church's adjusted statement was one of the strongest announcements of racism ever issued by the LDS church, and it should be applauded.
We have a complicated, well, no, that's not strong enough. We in the LDS church haven't been very good not only confronting our history with regards to race, but talking about the issue publicly.
We do have a few instances. For example, Gordon B. Hinckley's 2006 talk where he said this.
Racial strife still lives its ugly head. I am advised that even right here among us, there is some of this. I cannot understand how it can be. It seemed to me that we all rejoiced in the 1978 revelation given President Kimball. I was there in the temple at the time that happened. There was no doubt in my mind or in the minds of my associates that what was revealed was the mind and the will of the Lord. Now I am told that racial slurs and denigrating remarks are sometimes heard among us. I remind you that no man who makes disparaging remarks concerning those of another race can consider himself a true disciple of Christ, nor can he consider himself to be in harmony with the teachings of the Church of Christ. How can any man holding the Melchizedek priesthood arrogantly assume that he is eligible for the priesthood, whereas another who lives a righteous life but whose skin is of a different color is ineligible? Throughout my service as a member of the First Presidency, I have recognized and spoke a number of times on the diversity we see in our society. It is all about us, and we must make an effort to accommodate that diversity.
Second, the church doesn't usually make statements this explicit, which makes this whole situation even more powerful. But let's face it, just one statement isn't going to be enough.
For example, Zandra Vrains, a Black Mormon woman and a member of the Sisters in Zion blog and podcast, published an op-ed in the Deseret News this week stating that, quote, The last time the N-word was hurled at her was in April 2017, end quote, and that it was done by a fellow member of the church. This still needs to be talked about within our church. If people read one statement from the LDS church and think, well, that's it, we're done, we've solved racism, then we have a lot of work to do. It's a long road, and it will get uncomfortable. I'm really hoping this stays in the mind of those who are going to be speaking at General Conference, and I have a few thoughts on who could be some incredibly powerful speakers, including, not to do a spoiler alert, but including one particular general authority who is from Kenya.
But the racial tensions that we're experiencing go far beyond Mormonism, obviously. While we've always had white supremacists in our midst, they seem to become increasingly vocal, and it's scary. Quite honestly, I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around this madness. It feels like we've jumped into an alternate timeline. So to help us sort this all out, we turn now to an expert, Dr. Unicorn.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another edition of Dr. Unicorn.
Dr. Unicorn, are you there?
Yes, sorry. Yes, hi, I'm here.
Oh, I thought we got your voicemail there for a second. Hey, listen, Dr. Unicorn, we appreciate you coming on. So Brant and I have been discussing this rise of white nationalism and how it's just hard to wrap our minds around. And we're wondering if we're living in some sort of an alternate timeline. We understand that this is sort of the field that your research is focused on. So, Dr. Unicorn, what can you tell us about the possibilities of living in the wrong timeline?
Well, you know, Brian, thank you for having me on today. Yes, I've been very busy for the last several months, ever since the election, studying this possibility of alternate timelines and alternate realities and parallel universes. And I cannot be more surprised and ecstatic and terrified about the results that I've found. Since the election, November, December, January last year, we would hear all these people talking about this and using these phrases and using these figures of speech. And I thought that that's just what they were, analogies and metaphors and using this figurative language to sort of try to express how odd it felt, how surreal it felt. But then I remembered one day last year, Merriam-Webster's dictionary literally added a definition to the term literally to mean figuratively. And I thought, well, if literally can mean figuratively, then perhaps this figurative language could be actually true. So I hunkered down in my workshop laboratory, and I have discovered that in fact we are living on an alternate timeline. And you know, for months, I was under the impression that there was one correct timeline, one utopian timeline, one beautiful timeline where things like neo-Nazi rallies in the United States in 2017 surely didn't exist anymore. And that we were living on the wrong timeline, the bad timeline, the alternate 1985 or whatever, what have you. But turns out, if you'd like me to break some news on your show here, that my most recent discovery is in fact that there are many that are better than ours, and there are many that are terrifyingly worse.
So a few bad trips, it sounds like.
Well, one could say that, yes. But absolutely, forgive me for asking, but I have to ask this to everyone I meet. Have we met before?
Yes, we ran into you at the University of Utah.
Ah, that's right, that's right. Yeah, was that on this timeline, or can you line hop too?
It was on this one, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, yes, good, good. I recall, I do. I was there seeking the help of their physics department and thought, though, if you could timeline hop too, then you might be able to help me better than they were. They were a bit dismissive.
So let me ask, why are you so obsessed with what you call timeline hopping?
Because I want to get us back onto the one where Biff isn't the president.
And we'll just leave it there. You can follow Dr. Unicorn on his YouTube page and on his Facebook page. Just search Dr. Unicorn and, hey, it's been great having you.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
That was enlightening and scary and thought provoking. And I've got some thinking I need to do. We'll be right back, everyone, with Elizabeth Fenton.
If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspaper and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News or visit theculturalhall.com/Mormon-news-report for more information.
Tiki torch Nazis hanging around the college square. Tiki torch Nazis had to rob mom just to get there. Well, at least you could have taken time to cover your sweet faces, 'cause your boss is back at home now. Know your vile, disgusting races. Tiki torch Nazis hanging around with David Duke. Tiki torch Nazis, your presence makes me wanna puke. Do you really think you'll make extinct all traces of Barack? Go back from whence you came, from underneath your rock.
All right, we're joined today by a very special guest. Her name is Elizabeth Fenton. She is at the University of Vermont. She is in the College of Arts and Sciences in the English department. And Liz, you have a fascinating connection to Mormonism based on a course that you're teaching. So why don't you tell us, A, a little bit about your background, and B, a little bit about the course that you conducted this last year.
Sure. First, I just want to say thanks for having me. So my area of specialty is early U.S. literature, and I mainly cover the period from about 1770 to 1850. But I also have some interest in colonial America and the later 19th century. My main subfield, though, is American religious traditions, particularly American Christianity. And so the first book I wrote was on anti-Catholicism, which was kind of a study of U.S. Protestantism in general. And in the course of writing that, I read the Book of Mormon thinking, well, maybe it would have something to do with that project. It turned out not to have anything to do with that project. But it kind of stuck in my head. And so I told myself, well, when I finish this book, I'm going to go back to the Book of Mormon and maybe write some things about it, maybe see if I could work it into a course. And so I came at it in kind of a roundabout way, but I've been working on it for the last few years.
Now, Liz, after you finished reading the Book of Mormon, did you go see the play as a follow-up?
You know, I have to admit, I've never Broadway. Seen the musical. The tickets are
Oh, no.
I have the soundtrack, though. I listen to it in the car.
Yeah, might not be the best to listen to with kids around, but it's a good soundtrack nonetheless.
Yeah, that's some alone time, you know, car time.
So you started by reading the Book of Mormon for this other book that you're doing on Catholicism. Yeah. And then how did it transform into a course viewing the Book of Mormon as literature?
Well, like I said, after I read the Book of Mormon, I just couldn't get it out of my head. I thought this is a marvelous text. It's so rich. It has so many different avenues that you could go down to talk about. And so I started by just writing a little conference paper. This was probably 4 or 5 years ago, about representations of history writing in the Book of Mormon. Because the thing that first caught my attention about it was all of the ways it describes people writing down a history or telling their stories, and how difficult it is to tell a story, to finish a story, to pass plates from person to person and have the story continue. And so I thought, well, I would like to just think about what it means to write history in the Book of Mormon. And so I gave a little conference paper about that. And I met Jared Hickman, who's a professor in the English department at Johns Hopkins, at that conference. And he came up to me and he was like, hey, I liked your paper, and I'm also working on the Book of Mormon. Maybe we could do something together sometime. And then, you know, it's academia, so 2 years passed.
It was a quick turnaround is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, it was really fast. We got right on it. So a couple of years later, we decided that we put together a panel on the Book of Mormon for a conference, and that was successful. So then we started actually editing a collection of essays, which we just sent to a publisher last month. And so through that, I got to read a lot of different work on the Book of Mormon and hear a lot of different perspectives on the text. And it was something that I just kind of wanted to keep working on. And so it seemed kind of natural to try out a graduate seminar on it, drawing on all the work that and the research that I'd been doing in the process of putting that book together and doing some writing about it myself.
So tell me a little bit about the course. So I'm sorry about that. I was reading in, I think it was Religion and Politics, the website there, and they had talked about your course, and they said one of the things they did, your students did, was they spent 3 weeks reading the Book of Mormon in its entirety. Yes. So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, you had them do that, and then what else was involved with that course?
So I thought it would be very important if we were going to study the Book of Mormon to read the whole thing. And because a lot of people have really strong opinions about the Book of Mormon, having never cracked the spine. So I decided
totally
up front, right? We're going to do it. If we're going to talk about it, we're going to read it.
Incidentally, a typical Mormon takes about 3 years to read the Book of Mormon in its entirety. So 3 weeks, that's a crash course.
It was fast. Yeah. It was fast. And I think in hindsight, it would have been great to spend more time on it. But also, I got to be honest, the Book of Alma, it can be kind of a drag. So I think the students were also glad that I was like, just read it, just pound through it, because that's a lot of story. And so we spent 1 week pretty much exclusively on Alma, and then we read the beginning and the end, you know, around it. And so it worked pretty well, but it was fast. The students did say it was a lot of reading really fast. But they were really good sports about it. They came in and they did it. I got to hand it to them because it was a ton of work. So we spent the first month just talking about the Book of Mormon. We started with Terrell Givens's very short introduction, because I had one student with an LDS connection in the class, but nobody else had any knowledge coming in of the book or really of Mormonism at all. So I wanted to give them a little primer. So we started, then we read the whole book. And then each week for the rest of the semester, we read one or two other primary texts that would allow us to think about a potential context we might situate the Book of Mormon in. And I really did teach the class as a 19th century literature class. And so we, in the class, really tried to avoid discussion about whether or not students thought it was a 19th century text or whether or not students thought it was true. I was more interested in asking questions like, what would the book's 19th century readers have thought of it? And what were some contexts in the 19th century when the book showed up? What were some contexts that 19th century readers might have recognized in the text, regardless of their origins in the text itself? So we spent 1 week talking about the Second Great Awakening. And we read some Charles Grandison Finney. We spent a couple of weeks looking at other texts that posit a Hebrew origin for the Americas, not in the same way that the Book of Mormon does, but we read James Adair's History of the American Indians, William Apis's The Son of the Forest. We read Charles Brockton Brown's novel Wieland, which is a late 18th century novel, but it's about someone with religious questions, someone searching for religious answers. And so it was sort of a week by week, not really chronological, but kind of here's one angle we could look at the book through. And now, okay, let's switch gears and think about a slightly different angle. And what are all the different contexts we could cluster around this book to think about how its 19th century audience might have understood it?
You know, one of the reasons why I thought it was important that we had you on was I don't think it matters if you are a practicing Mormon or a disaffected or disaffiliated Mormon. No matter what, we are all coming in with some sort of baggage regarding the Book of Mormon because it's such a fixture within the LDS faith. But for you and your students, I thought it was much more interesting because you guys are taking a respectful, objective outsider approach. So you talked about it as far as literature, and you were looking at other pieces of literature within 19th century America that might be comparable or that might draw some similar connections to there. So where did you and your students, where would you place the Book of Mormon as far as a 19th century religious text or even 19th century literature? Does it stand out or is it fairly typical of what you might see? Where does it stand within 19th century America?
Oh, that's a great question. and not easy to answer. I think, well, it stands out. The one easy answer is it stands out because it's a narrative history, right? And so you can set it along alongside sermons of the 19th century. And of course, it looks very different, although it contains sermons within it. And so its genre sets it apart in some really significant ways. But a lot of the issues it touches on are hot button issues in the 19th century. Questions about things like infant baptism, for example. You know, Moroni has that kind of long section at the end where he offers something more like instructions for practice than the rest of the narrative has offered. And so in that, I think you can see certain generic properties that are a little bit more in line with 19th century texts that we might be more familiar with. I think that in some ways it's very 19th century in the sense that it's really interested in questions of what is the right faith practice? What does a person do when they have all these options in front of them? As people, 19th century people had a lot of church options to choose from. And in the Book of Mormon, there is a kind of, that's a text that begs the question, if you have all these options in front of you or different directions you might go, how do you know what's right? Which I know is something Smith himself talks about in his history, really kind of grappling with. So I think it's, you know, there are a lot of overlaps, but I also think that it is a kind of standalone text, just from my perspective, that's really doing some unique things.
So a couple of either literature-related or religious-related genres or trends that seem to be concurring with the coming forth of Book of Mormon to be like romanticism, for instance, right? A little bit of transcendentalism at this point. And then over on the kind of religious side, you got the rise of evangelism. Did you guys discuss those parallels between romantic literature, evangelical uprising, and this Mormon text?
We did. We read a couple of sort of typical traditional kind of romance novels of the period. So one thing we read was Catherine Sedgwick's A New England Tale, which is also in its own way a novel about, you know, how do you choose the right kind of Protestantism is what that novel is about. And we did talk a lot about figures like Cooper, or Sedgwick also wrote this novel, Hope Leslie, which is a kind of indigenous American adventure story and a romance with a small r. So we talked a lot about expectations that readers might have had around narratives of the period, sort of that this is a period that predates what we understand as realism, and that the kind of adventure in a faraway land is a 19th century American genre, but it also is a biblical genre. So there are significant overlaps between the way that authors in the 19th century US were telling stories and the kinds of biblical narratives that they would have been themselves very familiar with. So, and that's the thing that I think is really great about the Book of Mormon, is it's hard to situate it in just one genre and say, that's what this book is, and it's clear and its boundaries are obvious. So we spent a lot of time talking about how it's also a text that incorporates lots of different kinds of writing, kind of comfortably within its pages, or it's comfortable with its own sort of mixing and matching of styles. But we did spend a lot of time talking about the romantic. We also talked a bit about the Gothic when we read Charles Brockden Brown and that kind of, you know, danger in the wilderness sort of untrue story. So the students really, I think that they were happiest when we were reading novels. They seemed to like that better than the sermons I assigned. Go figure.
So not to be too snarky, but it's almost like the Book of Mormon is a bit more complex than everybody makes it out to be. Because it doesn't easily fit within one area or another, right? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, you know, it's, and my students really again and again marveled at kinds of contexts we could situate it in, all of the different kinds of ways you can talk about it. It's a text that just when you think you've sort of figured out what it's doing, the narrator shifts and it becomes a different kind of book. And so in that way, it's also a really enjoyable read because it just does so many different kinds of things that it's hard to put a single thesis around it and say, well, this is what the book is doing. So you mentioned
your students. What were their perceptions to the Book of Mormon? And from any stripe or perspective?
Well, I would say I did a lot of work up front in the class to say, you know, it's not an intellectual argument to say this is true or this is false. That's a different kind of question. That's a different kind of argument. Because I did have some students who it was hard for them at first. They had such, how do I want to put this? They had such a kind of, I don't want to say negative attitude toward the book, but like I said, I only had one student with an LDS connection. Most of my students, I think, had kind of osmosed the sort of anti-Mormon, you know, anti-Mormonism that is still pretty prevalent in U.S. culture. And so several of my students came in sort of with the preconception of like, this is ridiculous, or I have to demonstrate that I don't believe this, right? I don't want anyone to make the mistake of thinking I believe this. And so really up front, I just set a boundary and I said, that's not the conversation that I want to have, because that's not a literary critical conversation. And that's not an intellectual conversation. That's a conversation about belief, which may have a rational basis, but may not. And that's way above my pay grade, right? I'm just an English professor. So I can't tell you if it's true, right? And I certainly can't tell you if it's false. So, you know, the students at UVM typically are pretty secular students, or their religious backgrounds are kind of, you know, mainline Protestant or Reformed Jewish, a lot of our students are. And so if they have a religious background, it's usually that. And honestly, biblical literacy among my students is not usually very high. Just the student population, I think it's got a lot to do with just geography. And so a lot of the work I do in all my classes, not just the Book of Mormon, but just 19th century literature classes, are things like, what is the Exodus narrative, right? Or who was Moses, right? Who was Abraham? What do these words mean? Who are these people? And so we had to do, you know, so in some ways it was great because my students are a little bit like blank slates. You know, we can say, all right, here's this tradition. Here's the Second Great Awakening. Here are some things people were talking about. Here are some ways the Book of Mormon kind of talks about those things. And here are some places where it really departs from those conversations. And let's think about the gap between those poles and figure out what we think about it. So, but my students in general, I mean, they were great. They really, once they kind of figured out how I wanted to talk about it, they got on board and we had a wonderful time. So I was really grateful to them. The class was a success because they worked so hard.
So once you assured them that you weren't going to be bringing in the Mormon missionaries to...
I don't think they were too worried about that.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking about analyzing this through the lens of literary criticism, I was thinking about some of the literature theory, you know, lenses that I learned as an undergrad and how those could be applied to this, you know, such as things like critical race theory would be huge. Right. Yeah. In the Book of Mormon, or, you know, conflict theory, or, you know, maybe even taking a postmodernist take on it would be kind of weird. Right. Or feminist theory, since there's like no women at all in the book. Right. So it would be, you know, it'd be really interesting to kind of apply some of those different models on the Book of Mormon.
And that for me was one of the most fun things, because my specialty is religion and I'm a historicist. So I do a lot of archival research or just a lot of historical research. And I told my students at the beginning, I want you to do whatever you want, because this is a hard class. And it was so reading intensive. I said, I want this final project to be fun for you. So have at it, you know, and I had students in that class who were really into psychoanalysis, right. And who wanted to think about Lacan, which is not what I do, but I was like, go for it. I had one student who has a background in art history, who actually did a beautiful research project on 19th century Mormon art, representations of scenes from the Book of Mormon in later 19th century artistic productions. And it was wonderful. It was very beyond my field of expertise, but she did a great job with that. I had students who were interested in gender and wanted to write about the gender politics of the text one student did a project on 19th century parodies of the text and sort of used different kinds of textual analysis to think about the sort of early critical response and satires of the text. So it was the class showed me what a wide range of perspectives one could take on the book and produce something really smart.
I really hope that they included Mark Twain's infamous summary of the Book of Mormon as ether in print.
Yeah.
because speaking as a Mormon, I agree with him.
Maybe not Twain's finest moment, or maybe, I don't know.
It's a little slow. It's a little slow in parts. Let's just put it that way.
You know, it's still nicer than what he said about Cooper, right? So,
right.
I just have one more question for you, and so Liz, here's the interesting thing that I've seen, based on our perception from kind of being on the outside and kind of tracking how Mormonism is viewed within academic circles. It seems like the Book of Mormon, viewing it as literature, is something that's kind of exploding right now. I know your course is doing that, at least within our own Mormon Bloggernacle. We're having more and more people do that.
It's
a great place. Michael Austin has actually been really good. Is and looking at that. So the question is, what do you think is next? I mean, are you planning on any more ventures down the Book of Mormon road? Do you know if anyone else is looking at it from this literature type perspective?
Mm-hmm. I think there's been a real explosion in the field of interest in the Book of Mormon. And I partly credit Grant Hardy for this and his book, Understanding the Book of Mormon, which I think, one, offered a really wonderful primer to me. I mean, I come at this completely outside the world of Mormonism. And so when I was beginning work on the text, that was an invaluable resource for me. And I think that book, it has sparked a lot of interest and also a lot of critique, right? There are a lot of people who want to respond to Hardy's claims or who want to kind of refine or revise the work that he did. So I think that book really opened up the field. Yeah. And there has been a real, what do I want to say? There's been a kind of a little flurry of work that's really looking at the Book of Mormon almost by itself, or maybe clustering it like my class kind of did, within one context at a time, or thinking about it sort of as a kind of central text that we might put a context around. And I think what I'm starting to see happen a little bit more is the Book of Mormon sort of making its way into analyses that aren't just about early Mormonism, or that aren't just about that text itself. And I think one of the next moves in the field will be to think about the Book of Mormon as just one piece of some larger traditions, and not just this unique thing that we have to think about only on its own terms, only by itself all the time, but maybe as one among many things. The other thing that some people are starting to do that I think is wonderful is looking at literature of the 19th century that responded to the Book of Mormon. And so things like early Mormon poetry, for example, is something that I think a lot of, you know, more and more people are starting to recognize as its own kind of genre. And so it'll be interesting for me to see, is there a kind of new interest in Mormon literature in English literary studies or Americanist literary studies? Because I think that that's a really untapped avenue of inquiry in the field. So, and it will be interesting to see what kinds of critical perspectives people decide to come at it from. Most of the people reading it so far have been historicists like me, and people sort of interested in, okay, what's going on in the 1820s and 40s and 30s, and how can we think about the text there? But that can be a sort of narrow scope itself. So I'm expecting the field to expand a little bit as things move forward.
Well, I'm hoping it is too, simply from a selfish perspective, because I'm fascinated with all this stuff. And you had mentioned that you have a collection of essays that was sent to a publisher, so we could be seeing more stuff on the Book of Mormon coming out within the next little bit.
That's my hope. My hope, the book is with the press, and it's got some really great people in it, and I'm really hoping that it'll be out in the near future. So,
well, hey, if you and Jared are in on it, then I'm totally in, and I'll make sure I get my copy.
Well, thank you, Liz. Comes out.
Definitely. Yeah. Let us know. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And I hope we hear some more good stuff from you soon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
And we'll be right back.
Scriptures are complex, written over several thousand years by numerous authors from varying cultures and languages. Many passages contain multiple meanings and possible interpretations. Furthermore, our present cultural situation unavoidably colors our own means of interpretation. What scripture scholars undertake is a study of the cultural situation of the text. Contemporary Studies in Scripture is an exciting new series from Greg Coford Books, featuring authors whose works engage in rigorous textual analyses of the Bible and other LDS scripture. Written by Latter-day Saints for a Latter-day Saint audience, these books utilize the tools of historical criticism, literature, philosophy, and the sciences to celebrate the richness and complexity found in the standard works. This series will provide readers with new and fascinating ways to read, study, and reread these sacred texts.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by Today in Mormon History. This week, in 1992, Peggy Fletcher Stack and others began publicly breaking the story about the existence of the Strengthening Church Members Committee in the Salt Lake Tribune. Stack began her article claiming Mormon church leaders say they have a scriptural mandate to keep secret files on outspoken members. Historian Ross Peterson described his own grilling by his area presidency, who, quote, continually drew photocopied items out of the file and asked him about things he had written decades earlier. The file was sitting on the desk, but Mr. Peterson was not allowed to see its contents, end quote. Files are a strange carryover from a paranoia that resembles McCarthyism, said Peterson. The article went on to discuss Tom Truitt, a church librarian in the late 1970s, who told researchers in the LDS Historical Department that he was, quote, on a special assignment from the Brethren, end quote, to read all LDS historical articles, underline objectionable parts, and send them on to the Brethren. His clipping system was influential in having the one-volume history of the LDS Church, Story of the Latter-day Saints, removed from the shelves of the Deseret bookstores and dropped from the reading list at LDS institutes. Historian Linda Newell pointed out, quote, it's one thing to know who your enemies are, but it's quite another thing to label as an enemy church members who love the church, who work in the church, who pay their tithing, who go to the temple, and who only want to help the church, end quote.
Maybe William S. Burroughs was onto something when he wrote, paranoia is just having the right information.
You know what, Brian? Who says people didn't have fun before the internet, eh?
And that's our show. We'd like to thank Elizabeth Fenton for being our guest.
Remember to check out the Mormon News Report extended sessions on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com and search Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber.
And we'd like to thank Dr. Unicorn for joining us. Music was performed by Scott Holmes and Sandy and Richard Riccardi.
We'd especially like to thank you, our listeners. Thank you so very much. If you like what we're doing, you could tell your friends about us. And if you really, really want to help us out, you can go ahead and give us a review on iTunes. Just a little review goes a long way in helping people find us.
And if you'd like to reach us directly to let us know how we're doing, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com.
Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.